Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight, on Life Rattle number 1293, we feature three stories by new Life Rattle writer Nicholas Sangarides. Nicholas Sangarides was born in 1989 in Toronto to Cypriot and Chinese parents. His parents were illegally married in South Africa under apartheid and emigrated from Port Elizabeth to Toronto. Nicholas has a degree in philosophy and history of religion. His passion for wandering has led him cycling to Montreal, Vancouver, and San Francisco. Nicholas Sangarides is currently enrolled in Teachers College. He hopes to teach in a Toronto elementary school. All three of tonight's featured stories demonstrate the uncommon enthusiasm Nicholas Sangarides has for living life to the fullest and throwing himself wholeheartedly into his passions. As an author, his thoughtful observations and insights engage us and share insider views that we might otherwise not have considered. In our first story, we follow a young man into a butcher shop, where we pass tidy cuts of meat lined up in display cases, and then enter the back rooms, where workers at the slaughterhouse stations and on the killing floor question his desire to be a butcher. Let's listen now to Italian Leathers, written and read by Nicholas Sangarides.
Italian Leathers by Nicholas Sangarides. John stands tall next to the driver's side of his car as I drive onto the farm. The gravel crunches under my tires as I slow down. I shove the transmission into park, grab the key from the ignition, and slam the door without locking. Sorry I'm late. The roads were bad just as I left and... Squinting from the cold air and falling snow, I clutch my coat closed. Oh, it's okay. I just got here and I'm still smoking, eh? John huffs in a raspy smoker's voice, emphasizing his O's in the way many Eastern Canadians do. Standing at 6'3", with a beer gut and bald head, wearing black jeans and black leather jacket, John is more jolly than intimidating. If you're cold, you can go in, eh? The door is unlocked. No, it's okay. I'll wait for you. A light layer of snow coats the dirt ground. No foot tracks lead to the shop's front door. The store is painted red and the window panes white, the same as the barn attached to the back. John stares at a snow-covered tree with his head tilted. He makes a peace sign at his mouth and squints to focus on the final inhale of his cigarette. "Y'all ready to go?" John heaves. "Yep," I shout impulsively. "Oh, no," John stares down. What is it?" I ask, thinking he may have dropped cigarette ash on his pants. "Those won't do, eh? Ah, well, maybe no one will notice." I peer down to where John looks and stare at his heavy boots. Not knowing what to expect, I wore my Italian leather shoes. We open the door and a tiny bell attached above the frame goes off. John hollers at people behind the counter and then disappears as I stomp snow off my shoes. Cuts of meat lie in the front counter windows under low flickering light. John reappears from a back room wearing a navy overcoat. He points to a white hairnet on his shiny head. "Even I gotta wear one of these things, so go ahead." John takes a heavy breath in before finishing his sentence. "Put your coat in the back and get suited up." I emerge equipped in a navy coat and white hairnet. John waits patiently with hands behind his back. "Dan, this is Nicholas. He wants to be a butcher," John shouts. Dan cannot contain his laughter. Once the laughter ceases, Dan chops a butcher's knife into a heavy wooden block. He turns to me, stone-faced, and loudly whispers, "Kid, this is not something you want to be doing the rest of your life." Quiet blankets the room. Finally, John speaks. Nicholas, you want to see the back? Back? I ask, bewildered. The slaughterhouse. John heads to a heavy metal door. He beckons me with a whole hand. Come on, I'll show ya. Springs forcefully slam the door against my palms. The humid scent of mud distracts my efforts to slide through the crack, turning my nudge into a shoulder shove. I stagger out the crevice, startled by the sight of 15 unrecognizable, skinned and disemboweled bodies suspended from a roller coaster track on the ceiling. They hang by exposed shin muscles. Blood from faceless faces drips onto cold concrete. John's frame blocks my vision into the next room. A man about 50 years old examines me. I tread in his direction and take care to ensure that no blood touches my Italian leathers. He wears a long white coat, utility belt equipped with 3 different knives, and hairnets on his head and white beard. So you want to be a butcher? Before I have time to respond to his raised eyebrow, he says, Listen, I've been doing this for 35 years. Stay in school. John interrupts, This is the killing floor. 3 men work on 2 bodies in separate stations. The nearest employee carves the inside of one corpse, while the other 2 skin and gut another. The only carcass with skin hangs from its hind legs. Blood leaks from its mouth onto the floor and down a drain. It's a lamb. They're all lambs. I glance back at the already disassembled bodies and realize they are steaming and their muscles continue to contract. This is Mike. He inspects all the meat that goes out. John signals to beard hairnet man. That's the Portuguese over there. The Portuguese nods at us with hands inside a lamb torso. That's Joey, the owner's boy. Joey looks up and salutes us with his skinning knife. That's the Mennonite boy, Simon. I taught him everything he knows. Simon slices open a stomach over the blood drain to empty its contents. John exhales. It's dirty work, but someone's got to do it. Moments later, Joey drags lambskin to another heavy metal door. He throws it open with ease. A mound of skins lay stacked. What do they do with those? I gesture at the skins with my chin. Well, we send them to India or Italy, where they make coats or shoes, and they sell them back to us. Ain't that a bee? John laughs at his own joke. Simon pushes the hoisted lamb along the track towards the Portuguese, while Joey carries intestines to a garbage in the center of the room. The Portuguese shoves his lamb down the track toward the inspector. I dodge the swinging carcass as it makes its way around the bend. A few droplets of blood nearly splash my right shoe. Joey lowers the final non-skinned lamb onto a trough and begins to detach skin from muscle. Simon opens a door that leads to a small cage, and 3 animals enter. John points to them. Those are shit calves, he explains. They're male milking calves, so they aren't worth much. We can get a little meat from them, but they mostly end up as dog food. John interrupts my captivation. We shoot a bolt from an air gun into the brain. It doesn't kill them, so we call it stunning. When do they die? I regret the question as it escapes my lips. Just before all the blood is drained, John calmly replies. We have to keep them relaxed, or else adrenaline starts pumping blood into the muscle, which makes the meat useless. I peer at John and startle from the first blast. My eyes dart to see a calf collapse. Simon loads another cartridge into the gun and presses it against the skull of the second calf. Legs buckle and its heavy body hits the floor. The third calf doesn't move as the death hand points the gun between its eyes. A final bang and the calf drops. Simon tosses the gate up and shackles one calf's legs. He lifts the body with the push of a button. Once the calf is fully suspended, Simon heads back to the final lamb. Joey leaves his skinning post and lifts a curved knife from his belt. He slits the calf's throat and reaches his hand into the open cavity. Joey struggles inside the animal's chest, then pulls his hand out. Steaming blood pours onto the floor. The calf kicks the air and chains rattle. Soon the blood flow slows and becomes a light stream. Joey hoists the lamb off the trough and replaces it with the calf. He works on the lamb while Simon starts on the calf. Joey makes an incision up the body of the lamb and its intestines dangle out the slit. Reaching his belt to switch knives, Joey releases the innards from the open cavity and they splash onto the floor. Blood splatters his rubber boots. He scoops the contents off the floor and bear hugs them toward the garbage bins. John turns to me. "What do you think?" Before I can answer, Joey slips on a piece of intestine. Guts fly 3 feet into the air and land on my Italian leathers. Wet warmth coats my feet, and juices seep through the tongue of the shoe and soak my socks. The room is quiet when John asks, "So you still want to be a butcher?"
That was Italian Leathers, written and read by Nicholas Sangaritis. The influence of Sangaritis' family background is apparent in tonight's second story, where we are introduced to the original concept of a skinhead. In this first-hand tale, dangerous complications arise when members of a group of sharps, skinheads against racial prejudice, are confused with members of a white supremacist group because of their similar appearance. Let's listen now as Nicholas Sangaritis reads his story, Ambush Crew.
The Ambush Crew by Nicholas Sangaritis. I sit on the ledge of the bathtub after shaving my head. Slivers of short hair itch my neck. The drain doesn't clog, because I cut it every few days. A brief rinse and shave, then I'll get dressed. I step out and inspect my head to make sure I didn't miss any patches. I give myself a quick towel dry. Clothes are neatly laid across the bed. Doc Marten boots, white socks, a freshly pressed Fred Perry polo, tapered jeans with no creases, red suspenders, and a black bomber jacket with the word ambush stitched across the back in yellow thread. The ambush crew are few in numbers, and none of the original members remain. I guess they couldn't handle the stigma that goes along with being a skinhead. It wasn't until I reached high school that I defined myself as one. I was the only skinhead at the time, though not the kind portrayed in mainstream media. The skinhead culture began in the 60s when white inner-city youth began mixing with Caribbean immigrants, specifically from Jamaica. They listened to reggae music and dressed as they did because they were proud to be working class. In the 70s, the National Front, a white supremacist neo-Nazi group, adopted the image and perverted the word skinhead into what society perceives them as today. I confront the stigma on a daily basis. I know how people see me, and I know what they think. But I value people who judge based on my beliefs rather than on my physical appearance. I'm a sharp, not a neo-Nazi. The sharp movement began in New York City in the 80s to counter the National Front movement. The name stands for Skinheads Against Racial Prejudice. Given my family history, it's a topic embedded in my past. My parents emigrated from South Africa during apartheid. My father is Cypriot, my mother Chinese. In those days, Chinese people, along with blacks and anyone who wasn't of white European descent, were classified as colored. If my parents had been caught together, they would have been thrown in prison. After 5 years of dating in secrecy, and living in a run-down apartment building that the local police overlooked, they eloped and found refuge in Canada. The ambush crew meets every Friday night. We roam the streets and frequent a dingy basement pool hall that accepts our fake IDs, though none of us drink. It's raining tonight, so the four of us, Darren, Shelby, Andrews, and I, meet at Ronnie's pool hall. We notice three skins sitting at the bar. They look of legal age to drink, though not by much. We have never seen them before, but they're watching us. We rack a set of balls. They continue to stare. Shelby places the white ball at the head of the table. He pushes his pool cue forward, and the balls scramble. As the balls settle, I look over to the bar and see the skins are gone. The game goes on. Halfway through our match, Darren's phone rings and he wanders away from the jukebox. We pester him with pouted lips and kissing noises, asking if it's his girlfriend or his mommy. He quiets us with a middle finger, and we wait for him to finish his call. Moments later, we realize the caller is neither his mother nor his girlfriend. Something seems wrong. Darren approaches us. Those guys at the bar earlier, they're part of the Heritage Front. So what? Andrew says. Shelby answers in a quivering tone. They're a huge Canadian white supremacist group. What the hell are they doing out here? Andrews says. I don't know, man, but they jumped Aaron. Darren utters. He's in the hospital. The air is sucked out of the room. We gotta go, Shelby says, and paces frantically. We gotta leave here right now. And go where? They're probably waiting for us outside with bats. Andrews snaps. Darren stares at me with stern eyes. What do you want to do? He says in a calm tone. Let's meet them outside then, I say with a grin. Darren grabs an empty beer bottle by the neck and smashes the bottom. Andrews reaches across the pool table for the eight ball and stuffs it in his jacket pocket. Give me a sec, Shelby says, and disappears into the bathroom. I grip my pool cue. We wait and stare at the barred windows on the door leading to the surface. Where the hell is Shelby? Andrews asks impatiently. I'm ready, Shelby says from behind. He's holding the tank lid from the men's toilet. We howl in laughter. Darren stumbles back and knocks a beer bottle off the table. It bounces off the floor, and we laugh harder. Hey, put that back, you punk, the manager says from the bar. Sorry, Ronnie, shouts Shelby and mopes back to the washroom. When Shelby returns, Andrews hands him a heavy wooden handle umbrella. Why would you take the pool ball if you had this? He says. 'Cause I wanted it, Andrews replies. You know, Ronnie's gonna think it was me, Shelby whines. Guys, shut up, Darren demands. With weapons drawn, we tiptoe through the corridor in silence, even though it's the stairs to the surface we have to worry about. Making our way to the door, I push it slightly ajar and peek out. With the rain, it's impossible to hear if anyone waits for us out there. We decide to count down and run up the stairs. We charge the steps, and blinding light confronts us. A megaphone blasts. This is the police. Do not make any sudden moves. Toss your weapons to the floor and lay flat on the ground. I repeat, lay flat on the ground. You gotta be shitting me, Andrews says. We are handcuffed and put into two separate cruisers. I sit with Shelby against the wet leather, hands fastened behind our backs. One officer swipes our IDs into the computer, while the driver fills out paperwork. These are pretty good fakes, boys, he taunts. I let out a sigh and drop my head against the safety glass barrier between the front and back seats. At the station, we sit on a single bench handcuffed to each other. The room barely fits us shoulder to shoulder. Concrete walls surround us, and we sit at a table in the center of the room with a single lamp overhead and a two-way mirror across from us, exactly like in the movies. We wait. Finally, an officer enters the room. He's wearing a suit and holds a thin brown folder. He drops the file on the table and pulls a chair out for himself across from us. "So, you boys are at Ronnie's tonight," he says. "Just to play pool," Darren replies in a monotone voice. "Well, I got a black kid in the hospital, but I bet you wouldn't know anything about that, would you?" "What, Aaron Williams? Aaron's our buddy, man. Those Heritage Front dicks jumped him," Darren responds, enraged. "I got witnesses that say they saw this boy assaulted by skinheads." "I swear it wasn't us," Shelby says. "We were going to go see him." "See him with broken bottles and pool cues," he counters. We say nothing. Every pore on my body sweats. We sit in silence while the officer glares at us. The door swings open, and a uniformed officer breaks the tension. "Chief, it's not these punks. William's mother called. We have a description on the assailants. Cruiser 863 spotted them 15 minutes ago." The chief squints and nods at us silently. "I'm keeping your fake IDs," he says finally. I let out a sigh of relief. They uncuff us, and we file out the hallway. We walk past the front desk and into the lobby to sign release forms. Heading to the front door, the chief stops us. "Hey, give this back to Ronnie," and tosses us the 8-ball. Aaron recovered a few weeks later. The Heritage Front was eventually disbanded in 2005, only to be succeeded by other neo-Nazi groups, such as the Canadian Heritage Front, the Aryan Guard, and the National Socialist Party of Canada. The ambush crew was never the same after that night. The boys felt they were targets, looking the way they did. I felt that way too, though I guess it didn't matter, considering there were always a few of us together. We all retired our Doc Martens and grew out our hair. We still consider ourselves sharps and stand up against racism, bigotry, and homophobia. Being a skinhead is a mentality, not a look, and fashion isn't an identity. I still wear my ambush jacket, but in the end, I guess I couldn't handle the stigma of being a skinhead after all.
That was Ambush Crew, written and read by Nicholas Zangaridis. Tonight's final story takes us on the road with three friends cycling from Toronto to Montreal. En route, we learn much more than group cycling techniques from both our narrator and an extraordinary cycling enthusiast in his 70s. Let's listen now as Nicholas Zangaridis reads his story, R.L. Fletcher, Bicycle Repair.
R.L. Fletcher, Bicycle Repair by Nicholas Zangaridis. We were mentally in a bad place. When we hung up the phone, there was no "I love you" or "I can't wait till you're home." I'm 300 kilometers from her, but I'd feel just as distant if we were holding hands. Two friends and I are cycling from Toronto to Montreal. Patrick and I have made the journey before, but Nick is a new member of the team. We learned early in the trip that it's best to ride in a straight line. This formation cuts wind resistance and creates a draft, making it easier for the cyclist behind. Patrick is at the front, I follow, then Nick. We began our voyage at the worst possible moment for me, but we had a schedule to maintain, I couldn't disappoint the team by altering that plan. Cycling requires more mental strength than physical stamina, especially on a long journey. When in physical pain for an extended period of time, you tend to think about anything to take your mind away from thoughts of muscles tearing apart. What was going on between her and I made my mind a battlefield for 10 hours a day. On the second night, we rode into a town called Deseronto. We found a trailer park to sleep in and made friends with the owner's son. He gave us beer, and we shared stories around the campfire. In the morning, we disassembled our tents, packed the bags on the back of our bikes, heated water with our portable stove, and had a cup of tea and oatmeal before riding. I called her after lunch. We were angry at each other for no particular reason. Passive-aggressive remarks showed we no longer felt like we used to. It had been that way for a long time before the trip. I was upset when I got off the phone, not at her, but at myself. How could I have let my relationship get to this point? I had done so many things wrong to make her resent me. The team had seen me this way before. This time was no different. I guess it was no different to me either. We're somewhere 20 kilometers west of Kingston. I keep my head down and stay in formation. The sun blisters, and the road ahead sweats with mirages. We're shirtless and look like true cyclists, synced to each other's movements. When one of us moves, we all move, and when one of us slows, we all slow. Our tires are never more than 4 inches apart. The road is straight and narrow with no bike lanes. Just a short gravel shoulder and ditch running alongside the highway. We ride on the solid yellow line as single lane traffic whizzes by in both directions. I think of her. I look up to see a turning lane ahead. We get off the yellow line and stay in the lane to the right. When I look up again, Patrick cuts left on the main road just before the pavement ends. I'm now riding on loose gravel. I steer my tire toward the main road, and just as it touches the edge of the pavement, Nick hits the bags on the back of my bike, pushing me into the road. The weight of my bags pulls my bike backward and the front tire into the air. I smash the back of my helmet on the pavement and lay with my bare back on the sweltering concrete. In shock, I don't react to the Mack truck barreling down the lane I lie in. It comes 10 feet from my body before swerving into oncoming traffic. Silence. I lay in the road, outside of my body, as if watching from someone else's eyes. Eventually, I stumble off the pavement and collapse on the gravel shoulder. The driver of the truck gets out to make sure we are okay. I have a few scratches and burns from the road, but I'm alive. The impact dented the back of my helmet, and the visor snapped. The tires popped, and back wheel warped. There is no way we can fix this on our own. A flower delivery truck stops. The man had seen us on his way to Deseronto, and is heading back to Kingston, where there's certainly a bike repair shop. He offers to drive me, but only has space in his van for one person. I look at the internet browser on my phone and find R.L. Fletcher Bicycle Repair. I show the truck driver the address. On the way there, I decide that once the bike is fixed, I'm going back to Toronto. I can't handle riding another 300 kilometers. I quit. In 25 minutes, we are at the bike repair shop. Fletcher is 70 years old. As he fixes my bike, we speak about movies, music, politics, religion, women, men, health, his memories of the 70s, and his disdain for the 80s. We speak for 2 hours until the bike is fixed. He uncaps the valve on my tires and reaches for a bike pump. "Cycling keeps me healthy," he says. "Without cycling, I'd probably be gone by now. See that over there?" He points to an air compressor. "I don't need to use this bike pump, but I will till I can't any longer." Nick and Patrick arrive in high spirits. I'm happy to introduce them to Fletcher. He looks at their bikes and makes minor adjustments at no cost. After we say goodbye to Fletcher, we stand outside to figure out where to go next. I need polysporin and penicillin, but we all need to eat. Moments into riding, I realize I've forgotten something. We turn around, and the boys wait outside the shop. "Forget something, my boy?" He knows. "Would you mind if we took a photo, Mr. Fletcher?" I ask. I set the camera on a timer and place it on the ledge of his work table. I put my arm around him, and he stands as tall as he can. I'm a full head taller. I thank him, and we go on our way. I have tears in my eyes as we start again, and I didn't understand why. That evening, we make a fire and listen to Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding on repeat. I realize that I have been choosing to run away from my problems. It seems I will feel alone no matter where I am until I begin to work on myself instead of blaming others. I've been wasting time. Looks like nothing's gonna change. Everything still remains the same. I can't do what 10 people tell me to do, so I guess I'll remain the same. Sitting here, resting my bones, and this loneliness won't leave me alone. It's 2,000 miles I roamed just to make this dock my home. So I'm just gonna sit on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
That was Nicholas Sangaridis reading his story, R.L. Fletcher, Bicycle Repair. This concludes Life Rattle number 1293. My name is Lori Callis. I had the pleasure of recording Nicholas Sangaridis reading his stories. Life Rattle was created by Arnie Ackman and Guy Allen. Be sure to tune in next time for more new stories.